I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest in early September of 2005, at the beginning of his book, he writes he was standing on the banks of the Mississippi River. He was president of Tulane University. He was in the sodden grass of what used to be a football field waiting for a chopper that was going to get him and some of his staff out of the city of New Orleans. And his story is quite remarkable. He's the author of The Inevitable City, The Resurgence of New Orleans, and The Future of Urban America. Scott Cohen is our guest. Scott is the outgoing president of Tulane University and was very instrumental in the rebuilding of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. New Orleans City Business called him one of the 30 driving forces in New Orleans in the last 30 years. He was named by Time Magazine as one of the nation's top 10 best college presidents. He was appointed to head the Education Task Force on Ray Nagin's Bring New Orleans Back Commission. And the story in the book, he says, is about jumpstarting the university and rebuilding the city despite a miserably inadequate response from the federal government. It's about partnering with a historically black college in the recovery effort, about salvaging the education system, creating high-performing charter schools. It's about projects like GrowDat, an urban agricultural experiment, Roots of Music, a program that teaches middle schoolers how to play in brass bands, but only if they keep their grades up. And it's about all of the battles over the destruction of the housing projects and where hospitals were to be, and just a number of issues. It's hard to imagine the situation in which he found himself after that hurricane as president of a university, and he didn't know where the students were, and the buildings were a mess, and what a job, huh? We'll be welcoming phone calls for Scott during the course of this hour as we talk about The Inevitable City. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Leave messages for us on our Facebook page. We may read some of them, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hi, Scott. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen. It's nice to be with you.
Yeah, our pleasure. Take us back to where you start the book, because it's such a dramatic scene with you standing on the banks of the Mississippi. You don't know where your students are, the buildings are a mess, and you really don't know what's going on because you don't have access to communication and you've got to get out of the city to rebuild your university. It was such a striking description.
You know, it was a very chaotic time because we were actually at our Uptown campus. We have a couple campuses in New Orleans. We were at the Uptown campus, and we were able, by taking a boat and a golf cart and stealing a dump truck, to the Mississippi River, believe it or not. And there we began to hail down helicopters. And we knew one of them was coming for us, but we didn't know which one. So we had about two false starts over 2 or 3 days where we'd be on the Batcher, what they call the mud part of the Mississippi River, trying to hail down helicopters. They would hover down, they would look, and then they would take off. And finally, if you will, one came down for us. It was about a week afterwards, and we flew off to Patterson Air Base in Louisiana, and then we took a private plane to Houston, Texas. And quite honestly, Kathleen, when I got to Houston, Texas, you know, I went to a hotel. There were about 10 or 12 of my senior people who had gathered in Houston, Texas, and I actually had no idea the extent of the damage and what was going on in New Orleans, because since we had lost all communications, there was no way of telling other than the little piece of, you know, land that I was on that was now a river, or a lake, I should say, what was going on. So it took, it took me about 24 or 48 hours after I got to Houston, Texas, to realize the extent that this was such a great tragedy for our city and for our region.
Yeah. And you called your wife, and you were understandably pretty upset, and she told you, well, when you're upset, you usually make lists, and I'll bet your list could have been 10 pages long.
Well, you know, it turned out to be about 100 pages.
And my.
I have the flip charts from those days and weeks afterwards. So every day I start with a flip chart and say, well, this is what we have to get accomplished today. And what did we get accomplished the day before? And believe it or not, we kept up with those flip charts for about 3 months. And they tell an interesting history of the Katrina catastrophe just by reading what we did all during that time period. But it was the only way that, quite honestly, I could keep from being overwhelmed, because there was so much to do and you didn't know where to begin.
Mm-hmm.
So you started with the smallest task you possibly could and prioritizing them. And then as each day and week went by, you found out that cumulatively you were getting a lot done.
Yeah. And your primary responsibility, because you were president of Tulane, was to figure out what was going to happen with Tulane. You didn't know where the students were or the faculty or everybody was scattered.
Everybody was. So we had 13,000 students, and we had no idea where they were in the United States. We had 8,000 employees. We had no idea where they were. We have two major campuses in Orleans Parish. One was 100% flooded, and the others were two-thirds flooded. So for all intents and purposes, we didn't exist in the fall of 05. The only thing that existed was our athletic teams. Believe it or not, we kept our athletic teams up and running. They had to relocate to other universities. But we wanted people to realize we were still there, and we thought through athletics they could at least see our teams every single week compete, and knew that Tulane University was breathing and not necessarily thriving, but at least breathing and existing.
Yeah. And Tulane was and still remains, but at that time you were the largest private employer in the whole city, weren't you?
Absolutely. You know, we are the private largest employer. After the storm, we were the largest employer, period. And we are one of the two or three largest economic engines in New Orleans. So there was always this feeling that if Tulane couldn't get up and running, it would have an adverse impact on New Orleans, just like if New Orleans ultimately didn't become more healthy, it would have an adverse impact on us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I got so involved in the city, and I became a commissioner of the city, actually, in the aftermath of Katrina, and served as a commissioner for, I think it was about a year and a half, 2 years. And that's when I led the community-wide effort to sort of re-envision and develop a plan for a new school system.
Mm-hmm. You say, I think this is interesting, and it's understandable that you were president of Tulane 7 pre-Katrina years, but you say in a way you felt like a tourist, but since Katrina, you feel like you're more from New Orleans because you found, I mean, you met people all over the place. You got to know almost every nook and cranny of the city.
Absolutely, and that is exactly how I did felt. The first 7 years I was there, it always felt that I was from someplace else. I wasn't from there. But when Katrina happened, it sort of wiped the slate clean. We all rolled up our sleeves and got involved, and no matter where you were from, you were now from New Orleans, and you had a responsibility to play your role in helping the city to recover and to renew itself in many ways.
Mm-hmm. We just spent the first hour of our show talking about the PBS Frontline documentary, which is on tonight, which looks at schools in East Baton Rouge, actually, Parish. It's an interesting, I recommend it. But let's jump right into what happened in New Orleans, because in many ways you refashioned a school district, and you talk about all of the issues that had been there pre-Katrina, schools that may not have been as good for African-American students, racial tensions, et cetera, that after Katrina, they'd already been there. Now they were there tenfold, all the same issues. And a lot of them you could find when you look at schools, right?
Absolutely. If you looked at our school system, Kathleen, pre-Katrina, I think of the 100 largest urban areas in America, we were 97th, ranked 97th. The school board was under investigation by the FBI. We had gone through, I think, 7 or 8 superintendents in 10 or 11 years. If you went into many of the schools, there wasn't toilet paper, there wasn't, you know, writing paper or pencils for the kids. It was really a disaster. So when Katrina happened and the school system closed down for a period of time, it gave us an opportunity to re-envision, if you will, what the school system should be. And we took a period of 6 months to a year. And we began to build what I call a system of schools now rather than a school system. And as you know, because I know you've seen the book, is what we have done is we have decentralized decision-making down to the school level. And we've done this through creating really a system of schools using charter schools. And now 91% of all the students in New Orleans are now in charter schools.
And as you know, this is a controversy that's raging in cities all over the country, including the one from which I speak to you right now. Why did you go that route? Why did you go charter schools? And tell me what they mean, what your definition of a charter school would be, Scott.
Yes. And I'm glad you asked me that question, because I faced all the controversy. First of all, charter schools are a means to an end. They're not an end unto themselves, and people have to remember that. Just by chartering a school, it doesn't mean it's going to get any better. As a matter of fact, it could get worse.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are going to have charter schools, you have to invest a lot of time and dollars in human talent, the quality of the principal and the teachers there. If you don't invest in human talent, then the charter mechanism probably won't work for you. Now, the reason we decided to go the charter route was we believe that you should decentralize decision-making down to the school level and not have it up at the district level. The district could establish metrics of performance. They could provide the general direction. But the execution really has to be at the school level, and we believe strongly that principals and teachers are in the best position to do that. So we really believed in the concept of autonomous schools, and we just decided to use the vehicle of charters to make sure they were really autonomous. They're still public schools. They still get public funding. They still have strict rules of accountability they have to follow. And it worked in New Orleans, not just because we chartered them, because once again, that was just a means to an end. We invested an awful lot of money in principals and teachers and helping them to be successful, not just the charter mechanism itself.
You also, Tulane changed as a result of Katrina, not that there wasn't service work being done, but you really became a model for college students doing service work, I would imagine, much of it in schools.
Yes, you know, we became the first and still only major research university in the country that integrates public service into the core curriculum all 4 years undergraduates are with us.
Mm-hmm.
So from the day they walk into Tulane University to the day they graduate, they are expected to spend a lot of their time in the community. It could be in public schools, and a lot of them do spend their time in public schools, but it could be in hospitals. It could be anywhere. And we do this through a combination of what we call service learning courses, where they take a course in history, but part of that course is embedded in the community. Or their last 2 years, they can do independent study or internships. So there's very multiple ways they can achieve the goal. But it's all with this notion is we want you to spend a lot of time in the community applying what you're learning in the classroom to a real-life situation and interacting with people and circumstances that you probably wouldn't have if you hadn't come to Tulane University.
Mm-hmm. Your whole book is beautifully written, but let's go to the chapter with Ruby Bridges. Ruby, of course, an icon in the civil rights movement, and very important as we remember Brown versus the Board of Education, a young girl who was being escorted to the William France Elementary School in the Upper Ninth Ward by U.S. Marshals, one of four New Orleans schoolgirls, the first in the South to integrate the public schools. She's back in New Orleans. Post-Katrina, you're having lunch with her, and I would imagine you're talking about schools as well. And Katrina, what did you two talk about?
Well, it was really, first of all, her journey. As you know, she was memorialized in the painting, the wonderful painting you referred to. And what people don't realize, for many decades, she never really let it be known that she was the child, that she was Ruby Bridges. And it was only later in life that she began to understand the importance, and she began to come out publicly about who she was and the trials and tribulations that she had. And what she wanted to do was to, if you will, reinvigorate the France school and to make it into a school focused on social justice. So what she was talking to us about was, how do you go about chartering a school? What's the likelihood that we could get this chartered and to get it with a focus on social justice? That's what Ruby really wanted more than anything else. As you know, if you know, you looked at the chapter, the France school per se didn't come back in the same location that she had hoped, the name change, but we now have an emphasis on social justice, which is something very important to her and a message that carries on as she goes and lectures around the country.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that that is also a message that is carried by many of the people who are running New Orleans or who refashioned New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, that this idea of social justice was front and center?
It was. I mean, I think there were several things front and center. Social justice was, and social innovation, trying to find creative solutions to what seemed to be intractable problems. You know, that's the way we attacked the school system. We also went through a big effort at ethics reform in New Orleans, and they're still going through that process where we consolidated the levy boards, we consolidated the assessor's offices. So there's been a lot of innovation, both social innovation as well as for-profit innovation, if you will. And I think that all came out of Katrina because we were just trying to find solutions, you know, to problems we were having, and we wound up being a lot more creative than we otherwise would have been if Katrina hadn't happened.
How helpful was FEMA?
Oh, Kathleen.
I thought I might get that reaction.
I think they're very well-intentioned people. I think they meant the best, but in the very beginning, not helpful at all. Now, if I want to be fair to them, and there are days I want to be fair and days I don't want to be fair, so I'll be balanced today.
All right.
The days I want to be fair, they were overwhelmed. They had never envisioned a tragedy like this. And there's something called the Stafford Act that guides how, you know, FEMA deals with communities. And the Stafford Act never envisioned that a community the size of New Orleans would be essentially wiped out so quickly. So they were applying sort of the standard rules to an unusual situation, and it just didn't work. And it took them many, many months and even a few years to finally get that before things started to move the way they should. So I'd say initially I'd have to give them incredibly poor grades, but over time they began to adapt a little bit more. But it's always been a struggle with FEMA. And even today, you know, it's 9 years past Katrina, and many organizations are still dealing with FEMA, coming back to Katrina. It's a never-ending one.
So you had to get money in order to rebuild the city. In terms of the university, were alum helpful? Did you find, I know a lot of movie stars are associated with New Orleans, filmmakers and great jazz musicians, et cetera. Did you have to depend on outside sources of money, outside government?
Well, in the answer is yes. In the case of Tulane University, we sustained about $650 million worth of damage.
Wow.
And we got recovery from some of our insurance companies. Most of them did not want to pay the full value of the insurance, and we wound up having to mediate those cases. So I say insurance was one big part of it. Secondly, we actually had to go out and borrow money in order to continue to pay our bills. So borrowing was important to us. Third were contributions from alumni and friends. And, of course, FEMA also provided money during this process. So we cobbled together from about five or six different sources. When it's all said and done, we never recovered the $650 million. I mean, we are probably to this day out of pocket about $100 to $150 million because of it.
Mm-hmm.
But we did cobble together a lot of resources. And I would say insurance, FEMA, the generosity of others, were very big factors.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine, and I know you were front and center in the whole rebuilding efforts in New Orleans. When you talk about the ethics problems in New Orleans, what was going on with the school board, that it had been investigated by the FBI, I think many of us who haven't lived there or haven't been there, I haven't been there, had this sense that there was a lot of corruption in New Orleans. We'll talk about Ray Nagin in a moment here, but I would think that there were a lot of people who had different ideas about what was going to happen, and I'm wondering in terms of the education system, in terms of which neighborhoods are going to be rebuilt, what kinds of low-income housing might be built, all kinds of areas, if you didn't sort of duke it out at these meetings, or were you all kind to each other and listening to each other?
I think we were as civil as you possibly could be in a highly tense time, but it was very spirited. I have to say, some of the meetings got extraordinarily ugly. So, for example, as I was one of 17 commissioners of the city, as I mentioned, and we broke up into subgroups, and I did education. But there was a group dealing with land use, and that became a very, very ugly, difficult set of meetings because there was a feeling that maybe there were certain parts of the city we shouldn't rebuild again because we could never protect them. And obviously then people read into it things that was never intended, quite honestly. But it led to a lot of hurt feelings and a lot of angst within the community. So I would say every single major change we did didn't come without a lot of stress, without a lot of harsh words between people. But in the end, reasonable people came together and decided on a course of action. And, you know, one of the themes of my book, as I talk about, is you have to make contact. So, you know, these things are not easy. And the only way you get through them is you try to be transparent, you try to be open, you try to talk through them, you try to provide data, and you try to get through the emotion that people are having. But having said that, it was a very difficult period of time, and it still is in certain areas.
Yeah.
We're still going through some of that.
I'm sure it is. And I really appreciated, Scott, that you got behind the story of the story that would make headline news, these ideas promulgated by some that the African-American community, many people in the community, felt that Hurricane Katrina was a deliberate attempt to get rid of the African-American community in New Orleans. And you go into the history of how that thought came to be, which was fascinating.
Yeah, you know, and I felt particularly bad during that period of time because I guess maybe because I'm an academic, I can always see all sides of an argument.
Mm-hmm.
And also knowing a little bit about the history, there was a lot of conspiracy theories going around,
mm-hmm.
obviously, that first of all, I think the federal government didn't act fast enough because they didn't care about New Orleans because of its population and its profile,
mm-hmm.
ratio and socioeconomically. I don't put a lot of credence in any of those conspiracy theories. I do think it was a difficult, difficult situation. And unfortunately, the parts of the city that were hurt the most were where the poorest people happened to live.
Mm-hmm.
And the poorest people, unfortunately, were African Americans. And therefore, they got displaced at larger numbers than other people did. They found it more difficult to come back. And that did cause a lot of issues within our city. But I don't think it was some plot to say, well, let's change, if you will, the racial profile of the city. I don't think that was the case at all. And matter of fact, I think people wanted, one of the things that makes us such an iconic city is that we are very diverse. And we have this interesting history of race in the city. And I think it's one of our strengths. I think it's one of the beauties of New Orleans. But there are times, you know, when you have a crisis and things don't, it's difficult to appease everybody where some appear to be hurt disproportionately. In our particular case, it was the poorest of the poor, many of whom were African American.
Scott Cullen is our guest this hour. He has written about his experiences as president of Tulane University and then as a commissioner in the rebuilding of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina in his just-released book, The Inevitable City, The Resurgence of New Orleans and the Future of Urban America. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. A special appeal, we did so many shows post-Katrina in the immediate months following, and then we would do anniversary shows. I know a number of you from Wisconsin went down to help in the rebuilding efforts in New Orleans and had remarkable stories to tell. We had a number of people who came to Milwaukee, actually, as a result of Hurricane Katrina. Maybe you've been back and you can give eyewitness accounts of what's happened in the city. I can't believe it's been 9 years ago already. 9 years ago. We welcome your thoughts, your phone calls. We'll take them momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Our guest, the outgoing president of Tulane University and the author of The Inevitable City, The Resurgence of New Orleans and the Future of Urban America. 800-486-8655 is our number. Rick in Sheboygan, our first caller. Hi, Rick.
Hi there. It appears you're going to be discussing Ray Nagin's role in the debacle that occurred there, and I'll wait for those, but I did want to bring his name up because seems like he's gotten some shelter from the ramifications of what he was part of in that recovery effort or the lack thereof. So I'll just wait for your comments on Ray's situation now, how he's been convicted and
okay. Sentence
coming up. So, okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
Thanks. No shelter for him now. What was it like working with him, and what do you think of his conviction? Scott?
Well, first of all, I've known Ray Nagin, obviously, all the years that he was mayor and as a commissioner, worked for him directly. And in the first 4 years he was mayor, I thought Ray was really on the right track to really turn the city around. He came from an interesting background. He was not a politician by background. He was a businessman. And when he was first ran for office, he overwhelmingly got the vote, regardless of race. And he was doing, I think, a very good job. And then Katrina happened. And I think what people can't fully appreciate, and this is not an excuse for, you know, corruption or crime or anything else. It's not an excuse, but the tremendous stress it puts on you, especially when you, you know, are mayor of a city, governor of a state, president of a university, tremendous stress. And I think after Katrina, Ray just wasn't as disciplined and clear about what should be done and how it should be done. And ultimately strayed from the path. There's no question he did. His sentencing was 10 years, and there's two schools of thought. One is he didn't get enough years, and others who felt he got too many years. So Ray Nagin is not a guy that, from when I first knew him, I thought he was a deceitful, bad person, just the opposite, a very good family man, lovely wife, lovely children. And something happened, I believe, to him in Katrina, and I think the stress and the pressure got to him. And he strayed, and he strayed in ways he shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And now, obviously, he's getting his punishment for that, 10 years in jail. Now he'll appeal that, and we'll see what happens on appeal.
You, at one point in the book, say that your wife said she had never lived in a place where she's known so many people who've been in jail, not for violent crimes, but for white-collar misdeeds, shady dealings, and minor corruption.
Yes, she did, indeed did say that, and it's truthful. It is true that in New Orleans, but New Orleans and Louisiana is not the only state. I have to say, Kathleen, I was born and raised in New Jersey, and I could say the same thing about New Jersey. It just so happens in New Orleans and Louisiana, my wife actually met more people who actually had done some time for white-collar crimes. But somehow there's always been this taint of permissiveness and cutting corners. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, that does have to stop. And one of the silver linings, I think, of Katrina was a lot of these ethics reforms that I alluded to earlier, everything from the levy boards to the assessor's office and now to the police department. So I think things are headed in the same direction. New Orleans is obviously not the only city. Louisiana is not the only state that has these kinds of issues. It's around the country.
Sure.
But because of Katrina, we were in the spotlight more than others.
Yeah. Tell me about some of the things that Tulane did and that you did as commissioner. Some of these entrepreneurs who started businesses, that makes what will build a city again and make it thrive. And some of them were just very entrepreneurial and darned interesting.
Yeah, what happened was we began to develop a culture, if you will, of innovation after Katrina, because we had lots of problems, and people were saying, well, listen, if we get into the fray, we individually or collectively can change, whether it's the school system or the levy system or whatever it may be. So that gave rise, if you will, to an innovation class of people who just kept pushing and pushing the envelope for new solutions, either for new nonprofits or for new for-profits. And that now has caught hold, so that New Orleans really has gotten a reputation in recent years as a hotbed of social innovation, of new businesses that are now moving to the state. And I think people see possibilities in New Orleans that they didn't see before. But the other thing I think they're seeing is a healthier community. So right now we turned around the school system. So if you were a young family pre-Katrina, the first thing you'd ask is, what about the school system? And people tell you, well, it's not very good, but you can go to parochial school or private school and you'd wind up paying a lot of money. Now what they'll say is, listen, the public school's, you know, really getting much better. And if you come, you can begin to send your children to public schools. So I think we began to change the city around. They know the levy system is stronger than it ever was before. They know that, in fact, the violent crime rate is going down dramatically in New Orleans in recent years. They know that the Mayor Mitchell Andrew, has reached out to the Justice Department to improve the crime protection system. So they know all these things are going on, and we're getting a reputation as a better place to live and to raise your families and to create businesses.
Mm-hmm. Scott, I'm interested more in this collaboration that you had going back to schools. You had this Lusher K-12 selective admission school close to campus after Katrina, wanting to turn it into a K-12 school. You were bumping, you write, neighborhood African-American kids to make room for the privileged white kids of Tulane faculty. That was the perception on the part of some. And you say the answer was complicated. But you also talk about this school assuming control of, how do you pronounce it, Fortier High School?
Fortier High School,
one of the most troubled schools in the city, almost exclusively African-American. What did that mean, take control of it? What were you doing?
Basically, what happened was, before Katrina, Lusher School was K-8. It was a public school. We were able to charter it right after Katrina, but also make it K-12. And in order to be able to get the high school, we were able to take over a Fortier High School. So it was an empty building, because at that particular time, Fortier had been closed. So the school board gave the building to Lusher School so we could open up a high school. And then there was a feeling, I could understand why there was this feeling. Well, those people who were there before couldn't come back to it, because now it was part of Lusher. Mm. But the fact of the matter is, if you lived in the neighborhood, you could actually come back to it, because you could go to Lusher School. If you were in the neighborhood, you could go to it, even though it was a charter school and it was a selective admission school. But there was, the perception was that somehow we were trying to change Fortier's school to a different kind. And what we were doing was trying to extend Lusher and give more opportunities to more people to be able to go to Lusher School.
Mm-hmm.
The racial mix of Lusher today, interesting, is not substantially different than it was before Katrina, but now it's K-12.
Mm-hmm. What did you respond, and I believe you were in Congress responding to a senator or a member of the House, asking, and the question was asked at the time, well, this is just too big a thing that's happened. There's way too much money involved. Essentially, people were saying, let's just let New Orleans go.
Yeah, that remark was made to me. And I have to say, when it first made, you ever get speechless. You're not quite sure what to say, because it seems like such a ridiculous comment. And then as I was thinking about an answer, I kept thinking about, well, is this the new standard now for the United States, that if there's a disaster hits your community, you know, we don't want to rebuild that community because that disaster should happen again, could happen again? So, you know, my immediate response was, well, if this is a new standard for the United States, does that mean if there was another 9/11 on New York, we wouldn't build New York again? Or if there's an earthquake in San Francisco, you know, we wouldn't rebuild San Francisco? And I thought it was a ludicrous question, quite honestly, because disasters happen all the time. And we shouldn't say, well, we're not going to rebuild again because that disaster could happen. What we should have done was make sure that levee system was, you know, always fortified appropriately all during these years. And the fact of the matter, the Corps of Engineers didn't do that. And matter of fact, when we talk about Katrina, we don't refer to it as a natural disaster. We refer to it as a man-made disaster. Because if the Corps had done their job, we would not have had the flooding that we had during Katrina.
Yeah, and how are the levees now, Scott?
Much, much better, Kathleen. This is where the government and the Corps has really jumped in. I think they've spent about $12 to $14 billion fortifying the flood protection system, including the levees. And also there's now an effort to rebuild the wetlands, because that's another issue that has happened over the years that's caused great damage. So they're substantially stronger than they are. They certainly could withstand a 100-year storm. And probably something even worse than that. And they've been tested a couple times since Katrina. We've had some other hurricanes that, you know, were fairly severe. And thank goodness the flood protection system held out.
Mm-hmm. I think you say in the book that Katrina has been ranked the most expensive natural disaster in the history of this country. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's not a distinction you want, but that is correct.
And I know you're outgoing president now of Tulane. You've been there a long time. Are you going to stay living in New Orleans? Or do you feel like you are?
We are. We own a home in New Orleans, which we bought about a year and a half ago in anticipation of the time I would retire. And it's interesting, Kathleen, because when we first moved to New Orleans in the 1990s, we lived in Cleveland, Ohio. We thought we would do our, 10 years as president of Tulane and then go back to Cleveland or some other community. But because of Katrina, we really developed a lot of sweat equity in New Orleans and care very deeply about the community, the young people, and that it continued to thrive and to renew itself. So a large part of my next life, the next chapter of my work life, will be continuing my work on K through 12 education and an offshoot of that called disconnected youth, because that's a big issue in the United States and in New Orleans. So I'll stay very much connected to New Orleans and Tulane.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk more about the disconnected youth, and we'll do that in just one moment. We're speaking this hour with the outgoing president of Tulane University, who was a huge player in the rebuilding of New Orleans since Hurricane Katrina 9 years ago in August. He is the author of The Inevitable City, The Resurgence of New Orleans, and the Future of Urban America. He was made a commissioner after Hurricane Katrina, so he worked helping the city to rebuild, but his particular focus was on education, and they really changed the system in New Orleans. He says it's doing very well now. It has been somewhat controversial, but we can talk about that. We can talk about the levees. We can talk about why New Orleans is New Orleans. There are still 100,000 people, I believe, who have not returned. Will they return? Are they attracting new people to New Orleans? Are the issues that were present prior to Hurricane Katrina that were heightened, not as much help for people who are poor, people who are African American. We'll never forget those images of the Superdome. Have those issues been taken on? Here's how you reach our conversation. Feel free to do so, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Has anybody been to New Orleans recently, and were you there after Katrina? Do you notice a huge difference? Or even if you weren't there right after Katrina, because many people weren't, what are your impressions of the city now? Or what have they been? Why does it have this certain kind of mystique? We welcome your calls for Scott. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls, starting with Natalie in Spring Green. Hi, Natalie.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. So I am originally from Wisconsin, but I went to New Orleans two years after Katrina to teach down there. And I had been there previously, so I did get to see some of the before and after. And it was, when you say 9 years ago now, it's just amazing to me. But it was interesting to see. I think one thing from my perspective that Katrina did was it, I mean, pun intended, kind of washed up a lot of the issues that were going on down there that maybe not everyone was aware of. And that was kind of a good and a bad thing, but I think it was good. And especially in my, from my perspective, as far as the education system, it made a lot of people aware of what was going on down there. And people like me who are from all over, the United States got to come and teach at these schools. And I think, people have different ideas about it, whether they like that or not. But I think it really brought awareness to a lot of different people, and it brought different kind of fresh perspectives to the school system. You had a lot of people going in there who maybe had not experienced it before, who are teaching there now, and to kind of bring new ideas. And I think it was a good movement overall, kind of what New Orleans was doing with the schools. And just to comment, and people say, should we let New Orleans go? I don't think the people of New Orleans would let you let it go. One of the biggest things I saw that impressed me was just that the people of New Orleans love that city, and they're going to fight for it. And that was great. They take a lot of pride in it. So,
and where did you teach, Natalie? Where did you teach in New Orleans?
I taught in a charter school actually across the river, someplace called Algiers.
Mm-hmm. Scott. So, yeah, you can stay with us. Scott will talk. Hi, Scott.
Hi. First of all, Natalie, thank you for actually teaching down in New Orleans after Katrina. I think we all appreciated that. And you are right. I mean, nobody would have wished Katrina on New Orleans or any disaster on any city or country. But there are silver linings. And the silver linings was it provided, if you will, an opportunity, a responsibility to rebuild the city in a new image. And that's what's happened in New Orleans. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was not really to talk about New Orleans per se. The narrative is New Orleans. But it is to say, you know, does it take a Katrina before a city can rebuild itself? Can we do these things absent this bona fide crisis that we had? And I hope the answer is yes, because otherwise what's going to happen is our cities could deteriorate to the point where a bona fide crisis does occur, and then you change it. I'd like to think that cities are, you know, can really grab a hold of their own destiny and change before circumstances made them change. So one of the things I'm hoping that comes out of the book, quite honestly, is these lessons about a civil society, collective impact, individuals changing the systems themselves and not waiting for politicians to do it. And some of the things you referred to about the silver linings were done and led by people in the private sector, not led by people in the public sector.
Thank you, Natalie, very much for the call. And you did have people come from all over the country, didn't you, to help out?
We did, Kathleen. You know, you mentioned the people in Wisconsin, and I can remember people coming from the state. And we did from all over the United States. And even to this day, some groups still come every single year.
Huh.
So you take an area, you mentioned something which, you know, we haven't talked about, which is something we still worry about in the city. The population today is still about 100,000 less than it was, you know, pre-Katrina. And the people who didn't come back are some of the people that lived in those areas that had the greatest devastation. They moved to other cities and found a better way of life, better schools. But we wish they had come back, quite honestly, because that's their home and we wanted them to have that opportunity. The other side of the coin is a lot of new people moving to New Orleans, mainly younger people, coming because they're seeing the opportunities there to create new businesses or to go with startups, and they're excited about that.
Mm-hmm. Whatever happened, I don't even know if you know, the person who was in charge of making all the appointments, he was living on the first floor of the president's home, your home, at Tulane. What was his name? He had to leave, and you were terribly sorry because he was just a good friend, and but yeah, I think his...
Oh, yes. You're talking about Patrick, who worked
right.
House manager?
Right,
yes,
yeah.
Well, Patrick was the Air Force. He was originally from New Orleans. He had to leave, and he did, and he now is gainfully employed in another state in the South. Fortunately, he's having some health issues, but we stay in contact with him. Matter of fact, we recently sent him a copy of the book.
Oh, you did? Good.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I know you didn't know what happened to him for a while. That must have been terrible. So many people didn't know what had happened to people.
They didn't, you know, and they left, and some came back and some didn't come back. And, you know, that's one of the hardships, I think, that
right.
happened. You know, I talk in the book about what we did with the projects.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the people who lived in those projects that were then torn down and rebuilt, you know, never came back to them. So, you know, there are now, you know, fine places to live, but the people living in those places are different than what was before the storm.
And why do you think they have not come back, Scott?
You know, I think, Kathleen, it's a combination. I actually think for the most part they found a better life someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's true, then that's okay. I mean, if they found better schools or they found a job. In other cases, they just couldn't come back. They couldn't afford to come back. They couldn't afford to rebuild their house. Or to start over again. But I think that's one of the hardships that we all lament, that the population is what it is today, and a lot of people who wanted to come back for whatever reason have not.
And what about the housing? I know there are some pictures in the book of houses that have become models now, and a lot of money has gone into building some really nice houses. That must have been a massive effort.
It was. So you had the four big projects, which was public housing, and those... Great controversy about whether to tear those down and to rebuild. They were torn down and rebuilt into mixed-income housing. All of them are very attractive and doing some wonderful things. Then you have the Lower Ninth Ward, and that's you referred earlier to Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt was very instrumental in starting some project to rebuild homes in the Lower Ninth that are sustainable and very attractive homes. And the problem is the lower ninth hasn't come back the way people hoped. So what you have now in the lower ninth is a collection of houses as opposed to the sort of integrated community that we had before. But hopefully that will change over time.
Yeah.
Len Reggio, who was the founder of Barnes & Noble, built a whole community down there. He built 100 homes in one of the parts of the city. So a lot of people from outside the city came in and did marvelous things. Those are just two of them, but I could name literally hundreds of others.
Yeah. Thanks, Natalie, for your call. An email from Bob who wondered about, I haven't seen this, what you thought about the HBO series Tremé and the show on PBS last night about the tough campaign for city council.
Yeah. I thought the show was terrific. It really was. If anyone watched it, they took some shots at me early on some of the early episodes, quite honestly. John Goodman, who played a professor, I think professor was supposed to, I can't remember if he was at Tulane or not, took some shots at me personally because of some of the decisions. I thought the series was a wonderful, wonderful series and really portrayed New Orleans in just the way we are in many ways, especially that particular neighborhood of Tremé. So I thought it was great. Sorry to see it come to an end.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about New Orleans, because you write about becoming engaged with everything in New Orleans. So what have you become engaged in? You write about the music and the food and the artists and the history. It's New Orleans is kind of a unique place, isn't it?
That's an understatement.
I guess so.
That is an understatement. You know, I tell people that I've lived there 17 years now, and I still think I live on a movie set. One day they're going to take down the backdrop, and I'm going to see the real city. And I guess I got as close as I could to the real city during Katrina. But it really just is a very special place. I mean, Kathleen, it's the only place I know of in America that can lay claim to its own music, its own food, its own architecture, and its own language. And it's known for that, especially music and food. You know, you can always tell when you're with a New Orleanian, because if you're from New Orleans or you have lived in New Orleans a lot of years, you know, you'll inevitably talk about where was your last meal, where are you going to eat your next meal, and what's the best meal you've ever had in your life. So we are preoccupied with food. We are preoccupied with music. It's everywhere down there. And it makes it special. And, you know, as I say in the book and I alluded to earlier, I was born and raised in Jersey. And in many ways, there's similarities between Jersey and Louisiana. I have to say that really politics is one of them, I might add. New Jersey is a small state, and it has its own particular charms, as does the state of Louisiana. And New Orleans holds a special place in the state of Louisiana because it's quite different than any other city in the state.
Yeah. In Tulane, how's it doing now, Scott?
We're doing spectacularly well. I couldn't be more delighted. You know, we made a lot of difficult decisions after Katrina, many of them very controversial, and I cover all those controversies in the book, and, you know, a lot of people unhappy with me because of them. But as we look at the university 9 years later, it clearly is stronger and better than it was before Katrina, and probably stronger and better than it would have been if Katrina hadn't happened. So I feel really good about where the university is right now, and it's one of the reasons why I felt like it was time for a transition. Let somebody else now come and think about the next 10 years, because as long as I was there, I was always going to be known as the Katrina president. Mm. And it was time to get beyond Katrina and begin to think about the next decade, and I thought the timing of my transition was right.
Yeah. It is when you just sit back and think about it, and I know you have for writing this book. What you've been through the last 9 years is pretty phenomenal.
Well, you know, I have to say, you know, I had two presidencies. I served, you know, 7 years before Katrina and then 9 years after Katrina. I never thought I would, 9 years after Katrina, and two different presidencies. And quite honestly, you know, I wish Katrina hadn't happened, but I feel honored, and I mean that, honored and privileged to have served during Katrina and after Katrina. It gave purpose and meaning to my life that I've never felt before, purpose and a meaning, where I was there at a time of great need and you know, did my best to try to make things better for the university and for the city. And that will always give me a source of pride and satisfaction that I don't think I would have otherwise would have had.
Mm, that's quite a statement. Well, it's a beautiful book and quite profound. And thank you so much for being with us, Scott.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen. Very nice being with you.
Scott Cowan, the book is The Inevitable City: The Resurgence of New Orleans and the Future of Urban America. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. That will do it for us today. There are great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network, and we'll be with you again tomorrow, where during this time period we'll talk about the potential collapse of Western civilization. Huh? How's that for a topic? That's coming up tomorrow, and we hope you'll listen. Thanks.